Okay, so I don't know, Paul, if you wanted to kind of monitor the hands and call on people, and I'll do my best to answer.
Great. Also, just a quick note, if when you ask your question, if you could do it rather quickly, since there's a lot of us here. So, yes, and loudly as well. Yes.
Sure. Right. Well, a couple of things, and we could also talk about the flood, divine exasperation reaching its limit. Remember, God is on a different moral plane than we are, in the sense that God has the right to take life. It is not up to us. In fact, God commands the killing of Canaanites, or at least disabling their structures, precisely because, you know, and that is permissible because he is in charge. It's not as though this is to anyone who does, I don't like what that person's doing, or that those people are bringing harm, therefore I have a right to go and kill them, or something like that. Not at all. But in the case of God, God has a, you know, as Job said, you know, the Lord gives and the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Life is a gift from God, and God is not obligated to give people a certain amount of years. As he's not obligated at all to do that. Whatever life we have is a gift from him. And in the case of Sodom, remember, God had been talking with Abraham about the wickedness of the Sodomites. And there were not even 10 righteous people in the city so that the city could be salvaged. So it's basically God saying, you know, it's time. There is nothing, morally salvageable here in this city. And, you know, think of Noah, who is preaching for 120 years. No one listens to him. It's just his family who are rescued. So this is 120 years. And basically, God acting unilaterally, taking life, in one case by water, another by fire. But this is, again, God's righteous judgment. Again, God is one who has a certain, again, he is the author of life, and therefore, he is at a different moral plane in that regard than we are. So I would answer it along those lines. Yeah.
Do you think that was a bad idea?
Well, it's interesting. When there some people will point out the double standard, actually an earlier double standard, that foreigners could be charged interest, but Israelites could not be charged interest. Now, what are we talking about here? Well, when foreigners came, the interest that was being charged, this was in the context, as a number of scholars point out, business transactions. That these were not people who are saying, I'm really destitute, I don't have money, could I get a loan? No, these are people who are coming to Israel, likely investing, had capital to work with, and so charging them at a higher level of interest was permissible. And the context where it's talking about not charging your fellow Israelite interest is in the context of these situations of destitution, where you don't want to be a loan shark and really subject them to further grinding poverty by really not giving them any sort of a way of extricating themselves from it. So those are really two different situations. So again, in the Middle Ages, I would say, any time that you're using rapacious interest rates to keep people, down, not really giving them the opportunity to pay back legitimately over a certain period of time, but basically keeping them in poverty, that is certainly an egregious wrong.
Yes, here.
Yeah. Are there some harsh things in the Old Testament? Sure. But let me say this, and I do point this out in the book. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail here. There are 16 crimes that were punishable potentially by death. Now, you will have some kind of first occurrent illustrations of the severity of what God is talking about, like somebody who's picking up sticks to get for firewood on the Sabbath. or you have a rebellious, a wicked and rebellious son. This is a glutton and a drunkard, what Jesus was later called. So it was a real insult. You know, here probably someone who's the firstborn of the family, squandering the family's resources and leaving them impoverished. So it's a very self-centered, antisocial, anti-family act. So it wasn't as though you've got a teenager who's just not cleaning up his room or something. You've got someone who is acting in defiance against the family's well-being. And so God uses that as an example of taking that kind of, taking that sort of thing seriously. Now, and so permitting the punishability by death, but we see that, for example, in the book of Exodus, where there's an ox goring passage, and in that passage in Exodus 21, it talks about how that if a person allows his ox to gore another and doesn't pay attention to it, then he can be put to death because he's been negligent. Or he can be ransomed, and payment can be made. And so this would suggest that because it is not intentional murder, that there could be a lesser penalty affixed to the crime. In fact, a number of biblical scholars argue that the only crime that was punishable by death in the Old Testament, time after time, was to be cold-blooded murder. When there was intentional homicide, then that was to be punished without exception by death. But these other crimes, again, 15 out of the 16 of them, could be, including idolatry. Some people talk about how, unless someone is, say, a false teacher, then that would be a different thing. You do see some, this is something that God takes very seriously. The prophets of Baal, for example, in First Kings chapters, 18 and 19, that they're destroyed because they're misleading the people. That is, again, something that is taken very seriously. But in these other things, even adultery and so forth, though there is a lesser penalty that can be affixed to them. So it's not the sort of, widespread death penalty at every turn sort of response in of a punishment for these sorts of things. There is greater nuance there, and a number of biblical scholars acknowledge that. So just kind of a brief summary of that, but maybe we can, if you want to take a look at the book, you can. It talks about that a little more.
Let's go here on the right.
Yes. Okay. Well, it's helpful to look at what the treatment was for those who are taken in as foreign wives. If through, for example, warfare, Deuteronomy 20 talks about this and brings clarity to the issue. It's not as though it is a matter of, I'll just help myself to this woman. And a lot of people use that as they'll say the Bible permits rape. And a lot of critics will just throw that out. But actually, Israel had very stringent codes of what was to take place, that if a woman was to become a wife of an Israelite, prisoner of war, for example, she was to, shave her head, clip her fingernails, was to have a month of separation, kind of a mourning separation from her culture, from her family, from her religion and so forth, and was to be incorporated into the people of God. And this, the man who was interested in taking her as a wife could not touch her sexually until that month had transpired. So there is a context here, and adultery is simply not, again, rape and warfare was common in the ancient Near East, but Israel was very precise about this not taking place amongst the people. And certainly someone like Moses, who is legislating, who is giving the laws, who is very concerned about sexual impropriety, and you read Leviticus 18 and you see all sorts of laws regarding sexual immorality, and certainly Moses is not going to permit that sort of a thing to take place. So a little bit of context there might be helpful.
Here in the front.
Considering the Bible isn't infallible, this is either a contradiction or just the Jews lying for the sake of their own vanity. And so this would show that Bible isn't inspired word of God?
Well, let's go back to Joshua here. Joshua did all that Moses commanded. Now, is Joshua just saying that out of vanity, even though there are lots of survivors left? Well, no. I mean, we do see very clearly that there are lots of survivors, but that language, that very strong, sweeping language, is being used. So, again, if you understand, I think any ancient Near Easterner reading it would not see that there is some sort of a blatant contradiction here, but would rather see that this is the precisely the sweeping language that is typical of these ancient Near Eastern war texts that does not privilege, does not simply assume that that what is being told in a seemingly, shocking, straightforward way is actually straightforward and literal. So, again, I just point people back to the fact that you see lots and lots of survivors, but yet alongside of that, the claims that nothing was left alive that breathed, there were no survivors and so forth. So I just, again, point one back to that very tension and say, what are you going to do with that? So that's how I'd proceed. What's the purpose of that if you're saying destroy everything and don't really seem to mean that? Well, the ancient Near East is, again, just think of the, you look at funerals. When you look at funerals in the ancient Near East, I mean, there it is a mourning party, I mean, so to speak. I mean, there are women who are wailing, and they are hired wailers to join in with that. They're beating their breasts and so forth. Here in the West, we're very subdued, shedding tears perhaps, but nothing like the wailing that you see going on. And I think this is kind of an illustrative of the kind of outwardness, the kind of outward emotional expression that is typical of not only ancient Near Eastern behavior, but also of the texts that you read. And there is very strong, exaggerated language in the poetry. The language of the imprecatory psalms, a lot of people think, oh, how can you take that sort of thing literally? I didn't have enough space to squeeze in something on the imprecatory psalms, although they do that in my book, When God Goes to Starbucks. But I talk about Psalm 137, blessed is the one who dashes your babies against the rocks. Well, is that, that's very strong language. We think, wow, that's terrible. Well, the psalmist is not necessarily thinking in the coolest of moments here. It's not as though he literally wants this sort of a thing to happen. But it's just the outrage and the anger. It's kind of like what Miroslav Volf was talking about. When these Croatians are, when their villages are being destroyed, when their women are being raped, you feel like totally obliterating, all of their family and getting back everything that belongs to them, just totally destroying it and so forth. Well, that's just how you feel. And so when the Bible is using that very strong language of feeling, of exaggeration and so forth, I think we just need to take it for what it is rather than pressing the point home, because you just see it illustrated throughout the ancient Near East in the literature, and the Israelites were not separated from that and operating in a vacuum where what you see is what you get on the text, in the text. So hopefully that's helpful. Sure. Well, I mean, just think of, I mean, I don't know what your views on pacifism and just war are. I'm a just war theorist, and I would maintain that certain wars are just. An example that I regularly point to is the attempt to stop Hitler. And you can say, well, was this something that was just? I would say yes. Was this something that God would morally permit? Yes. But doesn't God love people in Germany? Yes. But does that mean that there should not be a stop put to this kind of activity? And I think when you think along those lines and try to maybe bring a kind of parallel along these lines where there are people engaging in destructive behavior, people who are destroying themselves, destroying, you know, and are pernicious influence on those around them, you want to contain that. You want to bring an end to that kind of an influence. You want to curtail as much as you can that kind of activity. And so, yes, I mean, it's precisely because you're motivated by love that you want to stop this sort of thing from happening. If somebody's trying to sell drugs to your kid, somebody's trying to seduce your daughter, you want to strangle that person. And if you don't feel like strangling that person, get some psychological help. I'm not saying that you would disagree. I'm just saying these are the sorts of things that I think we just don't get angry enough at things that are wrong in the world. And I guess when people just talk about God is love, I'd point them back to this quotation by Miroslav Volf. I think it's very telling, very powerful. Now, when you say those people, what do you... Well, I do talk about that in the book and would refer you to that. But let me just say a few things. God is really against the Israelites time after time. It's not as though they get most favored nation status here. They are people who are judged. I mean, they're put into exile. God is sending prophets to warn them. So you see the northern kingdom of Israel totally destroyed, scattered. By the Assyrians in 722 BC, and then you see the southern kingdom also receiving judgment in 586, 587 BC. You see there is judgment that is brought upon the people of Israel routinely. God is routinely angry with his people and bringing judgment to them. God says, just as I am dry, just as the land vomits the Canaanites out, I'm going to vomit you out. It's going to vomit you out, and you do see that thing happening in exile. So, it's again, God is not, in fact, the prophets, you'd think that if they were not Jews themselves, you'd think that they're a bunch of anti-Semites. The way that they're condemning Israel up and down, they are excoriating them, they are, they're madder than hornets. They are upset with the way that the Israelites are disregarding God and carrying on in their self-destructive ways. They are condemning Israel, calling Israel Sodom and Gomorrah and so forth. Very strong, strident language that is being used. But they're trying to wake up the people of Israel because they are heading to the destruction that they have, that the Canaanites themselves experienced. Well, I mean, yeah, there are some, it does perhaps, some people who say, well, I take the Bible literally. Well, whatever that means. Taking the Bible literally is so confusing and so misleading that I say, it's better to say I take the Bible literarily. That is, I take it according to the particular genres of scripture that are there. That, yes, there are some genres that are straightforward, like historical narrative and so forth. There are others, when you've got trees clapping their hands, you don't want to take that literally. You want to take it literarily. And so I would say there are some, again, in a culture that is often prone to or just given to making exaggerated claims without thinking that they're being misleading. I mean, you'll have, for example, Hezekiah, who is called, it says that before him there is none like him and after him there is none like him until you get to Josiah. When it says that there's none like him before or after. And it's not as though there is some sort of, oh, look at this discrepancy here. No, that's just the nature of the language. And so I would say just, know, by God's grace, let's all just keep reading the text together, keep on refining our understanding, looking at how the ancients read and understood these texts. And I think a lot of times even reading these sorts of texts, like reading with an African, reading with people from, you know, who are non-Westerners, I think a lot of times our eyes are opened in ways that we are often reading with blinders, unfortunately, just as Westerners, because we just don't have a feel for what is going on here, which many non-Westerners would readily understand. So again, reading the scriptures more carefully, reading them in community with other believers, and reading them cross-culturally, I think is often very helpful as we try to go deeper into the scriptures. So excellent question. Yeah. Now, isn't there something, misguided, something unjust, having to put people through a certain trauma in warfare? Well, I don't think you even need to talk about God. You don't even need to bring God into the picture. What about, say, the trauma of going into the Second World War? I mean, if you've seen the movie Saving Private Ryan, you see that there is indeed much trauma that goes on. That is a very... we're talking about even a just war is going to be very hard, very psychologically risky. There can be damage that is done. But does that mean that we just let Hitler go his way? Does that mean that we just say, this is just too much? Justice does not call me to this sort of a thing. Well, sometimes justice means taking great risks. Justice means subjecting ourselves to things that may be very difficult. One of the things that I mentioned in the book, I quote from The Lord of the Rings. And this, this is my trump card here, The Lord of the Rings. Where, Frodo is carrying the ring to Mount Doom, and with every step, this ring is getting heavier and more difficult to bear. His friend Samwise Gamgee is there to support him and so forth. And Samwise Gamgee says, it's not fair. He recognizes that this is something that has been thrust upon him that Frodo did not desire to do in the least. But yet those are the sorts of things that, even when Gandalf is talking to him, telling him that, it's not for us to choose the times in which we live. But what are we going to do with those things that are thrust upon us in these times? And yes, there are there are some very difficult things. I mean, I think of people who, police officers who put their lives on the line every day, people who are, often risking their lives, doing things. I mean, so we can sleep very comfortably in our homes. But our hats are off to those who are stopping people who are criminals. I mean, boy, I'd be a basket case if I had to be a police officer. But I'm really grateful for people who, sometimes risk mental illness because they believe in the importance of protecting innocent people. So, I don't even need to think we should bring God into the picture necessarily. But simply any time that there is justice, I mean, people who have to carry out certain, punishments under the law or who have to do some very difficult things, those things do fall to human beings, and I'd say, it's hard, but I think sometimes you have to ask, well, what is the alternative? Ignoring those things, letting them go? Well, you're only setting yourself up, I think, for a far worse moral scenario. So anyway, excellent question though. It's one that I've wrestled with. Mm-hmm. You've understood me correctly on that.
Okay. Only for the Israelites or also for the foreigners? Or was that one passage?
Yeah, that one passage, right. I mean, there you might have people who are a little, not all foreigners are going to necessarily be cooperative, and we need to take that into consideration too. People who say who are just in the normal fighting of trying to protect yourself, having prisoners of war, well, you're going to have people who are probably not going to be all that friendly to you, and so something needs to be done, like perhaps supervised hard labor or something like that, which it does indeed take place under David or Solomon. Yeah, Naaman, yeah.
And then, if he's displeased with her, after he's dishonored her, he can just let her go. I'm thinking, okay, now how does that fit under, compassionate and whatnot?
Yeah. Well, again, the passage in Deuteronomy 20 that you're citing basically says, think about people who get married and have cold feet and they back out. That's the sort of thing that we see, that he is not to treat her as someone who is, as an inferior or something like that. He is to give this woman her freedom. Because he has, he was intending to marry her, decided against it later on. But again, I'm not sure how that. I don't think that text is.
Exactly.
Well, yeah. I mean, shaving of her hair and everything. Yeah, this was to be a ritual that was to go through. There was, in a sense, a humiliation, so to speak.
So before the marriage.
Yes, before the marriage. Yeah, Deuteronomy 20 is talking about that. Yeah, exactly.
I'm not sure about that, but I think
There's another passage that talks, and I go into a lot of detail here, where it does talk about it looks like polygamy, but I argue that it's not. But it is someone who is to give a woman, that he is to give her conjugal rights, and I argue that that's a very poor translation, that he is not to disregard her, but to give her conjugal rights. Bad translation, and I go into detail on that. So there are a couple of passages that you perhaps could be bringing together, and I do sort them out in this, in the book, and the passage in Deuteronomy 20 to which you were referring is before the marriage, where she shaves her head, clips her nails, and so forth, and it is to be a separation from her culture and basically an introduction into Israelite culture, kind of a symbol of putting the past behind her. And so the humiliation that she goes through is to shave your head, that is, the hair was the woman's glory and so forth. And so for that to be shaved was a rite of passage into Israel, but not something that was pleasant at all. And so he had to treat her with dignity when he would let her go, because he decided against marrying her. So that's what the text is talking about. So. Yeah, that's called henicide. Pardon my foul language there. So, thought I'd lay that one on you there. Yeah, absolutely right. I mean, one of the things I was speaking at an open forum a few weeks ago. And I was, it was in Richard Dawkins, one of these new atheists, had come to Nova Southeastern University in Fort Lauderdale. Actually, if you look at my website, I have an audio clip of my question to Richard Dawkins, very dismissive of people who are religious. And so there's a little audio clip of my question to Richard Dawkins during the Q&A time. I was the first one up. He made some sort of he totally bypassed my question. One of the things that I said was, if, a little off track here, but I'll fill you in on my conversation with Richard Dawkins briefly, I said, it seems to me that if you believe that we are simply dancing to our DNA, was what Richard Dawkins says, that, and if the sorts of things that we believe have been produced in us by physical forces beyond our control, then I don't see how you think that the naturalist could be any more rational than the theist, because the same forces are at work pumping various non-rational beliefs into us. And that, and I said, I don't see how the naturalist can consider himself more rational, since the same forces are at work in both the you know, the non-rational forces are at work in both of us. So why think that one has a superior rational view over against the other? And, you know, he totally bypassed it. And he said, well, you know, science is rational because it works, and science sends people to the sends rockets to the moon, but religion flies planes into buildings. You know, that was the, you know, the really decisive trouncing of religion there. But, you know, one of the things that Richard Dawkins is is emphasizing is that, yeah, they're ultimately, you know, in a world of, he says in his book River Out of Eden, in a world of selfish genes and electrons, there is nothing left but blind, pitiless indifference. So you're right. Why would the atheist get upset at all about any genocide? You know, about any mistreatment of animals? You know, after all, we have been produced by material, deterministic, valueless processes, these forces beyond our control. And so why think that any value could emerge from that series of valueless processes? So, excellent question. Yeah, follow up. Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, that's one of my routine criticisms. If you're going to, what's ironic is that the leading criticism of theism is the problem of evil. But how on naturalism can you even talk about evil, which assumes a standard or design plan of the way things ought to be? Why, you know, C.S. Lewis talked about this. He said, how do we know what is crooked unless we have an idea of what is straight? If naturalism is all that there is, then this is just the way things are. There is no way things ought to be. And so it does become, they are borrowing from a theistic framework in order to launch their moral arguments against the theist. Exactly right.
It's time for one more question.
I mean, there are people who will, you know, I mean, I have read various Jewish commentators. There are various Nahum Sarna and others who do really go into a lot of detail. Joseph Milgram will, you know, Jewish commentators who will talk about these sorts of issues, you know, Jewish context, and will offer, you know, reasoned arguments. I mean, I don't see them engaging as much in, you know, in the kind of the apologetical sort of thing that I think a lot of Christian Old Testament commentators engage in. But there are some. Maybe I just need to get out more. But from what I've been able to come across, I mean, you'll find a smattering of things here and there. But I think the more concentrated effort is on the part of the Christian Old Testament scholars.
Let's join thanking our guest for his time.
Great to be with you. Thank you.
Thank you.